Call the meeting to order. Mr. Kendall, do you please lead us in the pledge?
Absolutely. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mrs. Stucker, will you please call the roll?
Mr. Stolak?
Here.
Mr. Ellis?
Here.
Mr. Smith? Mr. Kenwood?
Here.
Here.
Mrs. Dollar.
Here.
Mr.
Bonner. Here. Okay, at this time, we have public participation. Are there any members of the public who wish to address the board? Okay, seeing none. First up, we have presentations, reports, and initiative updates.
Our presentation this evening is with Karen Carlson, and she will be assisted by Stacey Onak, who is here with her. And they are going to talk about a collection of interventions that we have in place in the district for our struggling students. And Karen, of course, needs no introduction to this board.
And Stacey, you can kind of more of these in a conference in case, but I don't know if you've all met Stacey. Stacey's our assistant director for special services. And she is connected to really pieces of the first part of the program and then the second part of the program as well. So, and as Ann mentioned too, we're really focusing tonight on the interventions for our at-risk kids, really those kids who are performing at the 30th percentile and below.
Sure. Dim the lights a little.
Thank you.
There,
30th percentile in our district or
compared nationally?
Compared nationally. Which is what percentage of our district? Sorry to...
Right off the bat, it's a question for Kenny.
Sure, it's in here. Let's find it.
Rough estimate, 10, 20, I don't know. Below 10?
Well, part of it, too, is there's other factors that we kind of discovered as we looked at it, too. Because when you've got kids who are also identified as ELL and special ed, that kind of changes the complexity. But really, it's probably more between 5 and 8% is what I would...
Of our district, so this is 5 to
8. So it's... The other thing, too, is we're really focusing on the elementary interventions. If you recall, too, when we had the Hadley presentation, they talked a little bit about their interventions as well. So the first one we kind of want to highlight are those reading improvement services.
Sorry, Karen.
Yes.
I don't have a mathematical question, but is this is a mandate? This is a program that's done?
Reading improvement is not. The RTI is.
So reading improvement is not a mandate. But we have a component of here that's funded through a mandate?
Title I funds cover some of the reading improvement program. And we used to have reading improvement funds, too, as well.
There used to be a reading improvement block grant, which was eliminated this year.
I'm asking the question because what I thought I heard at the beginning was this was targeted to the lower 30%.
Higher-risk students.
Higher-risk students. Is that a mandate that we're supposed to do that, or is that just what we decided to do?
Well, in the big picture, intervention, the mandate for response to intervention, which will be part of this report, is a mandate. That's a federal mandate. Intervention for our highest risk learners is a choice.
Okay. So we're covering the at-risk bottom 30%.
In various ways that we support them.
Okay.
RTI being the mandate that you have to provide an intervention. Reading Improvement Services is a service we offer to address response to intervention, but reading improvement in and of itself is not a mandate. Summer school in and of itself is not a mandate.
So I just the scope of this is not for the other 70%. No, there are other programs in place for reading improvement for those that are in the top 10% as well as the 50% element.
Correct.
Okay.
Though not formalized to the extent that our reading improvement and our primary reading interventions services are.
And you'll see, it'll briefly kind of be touched on when you see that tier one. But as Dan mentioned, really, RTI is the federal mandate. You think of the reading improvement and summer school as two programs that help address the needs of those kids within that. With reading improvement, we did a program evaluation back in the spring of 2007. And you probably recall we called it PRIS for a while, which is Primary Reading Intervention Services. And since that time, it's really evolved kind of based on that program review and then in addition to better meet the needs of the building. But we originally, it was just targeting kids in K through 3. We didn't start with kindergarten until January, and it was always very few third graders who received those services. And back then, we were using a program called Jumpstart, and that was a one-to-one program for first graders, which was based kind of on the reading recovery model, which is a very intense reading recovery for first graders, which is delivered one-on-one. There was small group instruction at second grade, the third grade, and kindergarten was small group as well. Following that program evaluation, kind of based on the data and the feedback, Lenore Johnson from the ROE was the person who had done that evaluation for us. We made some changes to kind of move towards that greater consistent identification procedures. We really started focusing on specific data points, more than just the ISO, which is the Illinois Snapshot of Early Literacy. And then we kind of looked at our kids more district-wide as well. And we developed kind of consistent entrance and exit criteria. We were probably using a little bit more teacher recommendation back then. And the problem we saw with the exit criteria is that teachers never kind of wanted to let them out of the program. They were making good progress. So, you know, and what we wanted to do was get them in, help them, and move them out. So we have made some of those changes. We also moved to begin kindergarten services in the fall. Based on feedback from teachers, kids who were struggling in January, they knew were struggling in the fall. So we've made some changes to that as well, and I'll talk a little bit about what that looks like on the next page in that. And the first year following the recommendation, or the program evaluation, we did a district sweep. All of the reading assistants went out and they tested all of the kids at all the different buildings. And then we identified globally and we reassigned the reading assistants based on that, and people did not like it that year at all. And part of it was we kind of took the assistants out of their element. They knew kids and the teachers, and so that was hard for them, and then they were bumped to different buildings and that. So kind of based on that feedback from teachers at the building and even the principals, we had someone who actually had kind of resigned that year, which brought us down to 12. We just kind of shifted. We had 3 at each school. So that's where we're currently at. There are currently 3 reading assistants in each of the elementary schools. We then also, you know, as I mentioned, we were using that Jumpstart program, which was a one-to-one. And that's not a very cost-efficient way to have one assistant with one child in that. So we looked for intervention materials that would be more cost-efficient, but also aligned to our Gen Ed curriculum. Mm-hmm. And that's where we landed on what we call, we often refer to it as LLI, but it's a leveled literacy intervention. It uses the Fountas and Snell benchmark assessment system to help with that identification and ability to progress monitor. And then it uses that small group of 1 to 3. We've done some experimenting, and sometimes we'll do kind of a 1 to 4, but we try not to go beyond that. There's a reason for the maximum of 3 kids.
I'm sorry, can I ask, you've said a couple of times cost efficiency, but I just want to make sure that we're clear that this is best practice as well. It's not just cost efficiency, but that this is educationally the best practice.
It is, and it's still kind of based on a lot of the premises found in reading recovery with the strategies they use for kids. So it is based on those best practices, but it's also a strong alignment to the Gen Ed curriculum, which is important.
And grounded fundamentally in the intervention of early intervention being the most successful.
Mm-hmm. With the LLI, kids have to start being able to read. So we have what we call our pre-A groups, and those are our kindergarten groups. They're working on the concepts of print, you know, that you move from left to right, you know, top to bottom in a book, those kinds of things. And then something called Guided Reading Plus, which is taking the concept of that guided reading group and doing something a little bit tighter and more structured for kids who are beyond the reading levels of LLI, but they're still below grade level. So a lot of our third, fourth, and fifth graders are working in a Guided Reading Plus group. And that's a change that occurred really this last year, because when the buildings implemented targeted learning time, they aligned the time at which they wanted the kids to receive their services to that half-hour block of intervention time. So those reading assistants became kind of more available to service all kids. What it does is it probably diminished the number of kids that could receive those services K through 2, because now you're going to be servicing 3, 4, and 5. So we've stretched them a little bit thinner, but we've also added services to our more at-risk kids at the intermediate grades as well. So when you divide that up, it's really about 9 kids per grade level per building that are serviced. But what we're finding, and Stacy really, as she started working with the buildings through RTI, we know that the needs of the buildings vary greatly, and it's one of those things we want to kind of take a look at this year to make sure we're meeting the needs of those most at-risk kids at all of the schools. With the Guided Reading Plus, a lot of times they may take a group of 4 or 5 as well. So you might have a few more kids at 4th and 5th grade who are getting services from the reading assistants and that. But based on that, we'll kind of go back to reconsidering that reallocation of staff really based on the needs, whether it's the sweep or we look at the data and kind of adjust things and then have some consistent parameters. Because when we looked at the data, we found that in some of our buildings, some of our special ed kids are also getting LLI from a reading assistant, and we're not sure that, you know, we really need to look at that data, because if LLI is more appropriate than a special ed resource, who could be that person that would deliver it in that? So we'll continue to look at that. The other thing that's important, and I'm going to go back to this tier concept, is the reading improvement services really address the needs of those kids at a tier 2. And when we get to that slide through the RTI, we'll see more about what that means. Nancy Moog worked on trying to pull the data for, to kind of put a whole data slide in here. And she said it was like one of the hardest data pulls she's ever had to do, because the shift in the programs and how we identify kids, and we're now flagging them in SIRS, but they're not being progress monitored that way in the data warehouse. So she just used MAP data because that was the most consistent data source she had. So just generally speaking, those that have been receiving service, they've continued to make progress over the 3 years. We noticed that their rate of growth is a little bit slower than those of their peers who didn't need or receive the services. All but one grade level show growth, both from fall to spring and fall to fall. And that fall to fall growth is important because we don't always see that as well. We did notice that if they were in the program for more than 2 years, they did show a slower rate of growth. And that would make sense, but then we need to step back. Do they need something more, a more intense intervention? Do some of those kids move to special ed and that? The ideal data point for us to be using is really that Fountas and Pinnell reading level. Currently in the data warehouse, the teachers administer that twice a year, fall and spring, and it gets entered. But we don't have that monitoring of the kids along the way, and our reading assistants are monitoring them on a regular basis with a running record, which is a huge component of that Fountas and Pinnell. So as a result, I'm going to be with the literacy specialist. Nancy Moog's going to join us, and then probably Gail Minkus as well, to really kind of figure out what that data collection could and should look like that would be consistent and we could really track them over time. Because what we'd like to be able to do is say, you know, when these kids are in fifth grade, you know, where are they at? Have they maintained, you know, at least are they near grade level and maintain that growth, or do they slip back at some point, mm-hmm. to really see if the program's doing what we want it to do. I can tell you the literacy specialists really like the type of intervention we're using. We are using it at Lincoln a lot with our newcomers, and we're going to kind of look at that data a little separately because we know that the intervention materials were never field tested on those kids, so it's really kind of our own data, but we want to just see if it, and there's not a lot of interventions, I would tell you, in general for ELL kids, particularly a newcomer population, so we just want to see from our own perspective if it's working. We anticipate it'll be a slightly slower rate of growth, but teacher's impression is that they feel like the kids are making progress.
Mm-hmm. Karen, does this...
Go ahead, Erica.
Does this tie back to when we had the program review that Karen Beeman...
Yes, our, you know,
she spoke about and gave the showed that slide of the academic language and how there's that shift. Is that what you were going to say too?
Yeah,
so I feel like we keep coming back, you know, back to this and want to remind ourselves that inherent in the research, we know that these our children coming in at this level are going to have a different level of improvement just because of the academic language versus social language, those things that she discussed.
Exactly. And the other complication to that is our Spanish bilingual kids, because one of the things we've learned over time is that they learn to read differently than we do in English. And we have to be careful. We haven't used these material with our Spanish bilingual population just because it would not be a good fit, and there are not a lot of intervention materials out there. LLI is actually coming out with a Spanish version this spring that we're going to take a look at, just to really kind of, you know, look at it, because there aren't really options out there. Is it something worthwhile investing in to offer them kind of the same thing? But it's kind of exactly what Karen talked about.
But transfer, expand what Karen talked about to English as your only language students, too. I mean, these are students where English is their first language, but the same concept applies.
Right. Yeah.
The other piece with that is we want to be sure that LLI is not their only intervention for an ELL child. They still need to be developing their English language proficiency skills, as opposed to this is really about literacy, which it's connected, but it's not enough. So they still need that. And ELL services are not their intervention, and that's the other important thing to remember, that there's a focus for that as well. So we're going to kind of move on to that second, kind of shift gears a little bit, but this is the federally mandated program. And you can see up there, it's called response to intervention, but really what it is response to instruction. Because you'll notice as we kind of go through some of it, that it is really about kids responding to the instruction that they're receiving in the classroom. And this is kind of something when Stacy began her work this fall at the buildings emphasized greatly with them, is it really is that kids are or are not responding to that general ed instruction that's occurring. There are really two purposes to RTI. One is to ultimately or possibly identify kids as having a learning disability as part of that special ed process. And the other is to provide those interventions, you know, to intervene and give them what they need to kind of close that achievement gap, and hopefully they'll be fine. The ironic thing is, even though a strand of that is about identification, RTI is considered a general education initiative. It's not a special ed initiative. I will tell you, that's where I think a lot of districts have struggled, and we even had a lot of conversations. Should this rest in special ed? Should it just be in gen ed? But I think ultimately you need to rely on the expertise of your special educators who have the knowledge on some of those modifications and accommodations and special skills that kids will need to either respond to or not to respond to as they move through those tiers.
Do kids who receive RTI service, or do they have a 504?
Not necessarily.
They could, but they may not.
But they may not. Okay.
They do have to have an intervention plan, though.
But it's not the 504 down the... I mean, not necessarily down the...
They would be separate documents.
Okay. They would be. Okay. 504 would be separate. If you can read that little tiny print up there, it really kind of gives you a definition of what response to intervention or instruction is. It's a general definition. But you can see up there, it really states that... if they're not making progress, then changes to that instruction need to occur. And it can occur at different levels. So when you see that, this is the traditional kind of, and it's what we've seen a lot through the whole RTI process, is this three-tiered approach, and it looks like the triangle. So 80% of students most students, would function within Tier 1, which is really your general ed curriculum. And you may need differentiated instruction within there. Teachers would do things just as part of their normal differentiation to meet the needs of at least 50% of the kids. And in our district, it may be more than that. But generally speaking, this is how they've defined that first tier of the model. And you can see there's two strands. We'll have that academic side, and then we've got the behavioral side. For the behavior, we're implementing what you'll hear as PBIS, which is Positive Behavioral Interventions and Support. And we're just getting started with that. Franklin's on their second year of implementation, and the other buildings are on their first year. But so you've got most of your kids functioning in Tier 1. And I'll kind of take you through that process. When it's not working, you'll find kids then who will be in Tier 2. That's Reading Improvement Program, the LLI, use of the LLI, the Guided Reading Plus, the Pre-A groups. That's a Tier 2 intervention. That's an example of a Tier 2 intervention. You will find other programs used at the school. I'm thinking of aerobics as another example that's often used. It's a computer program that works on awareness, I believe, too. So, but there's just different, in other words, they're, it's not part of the gen ed curriculum, and it could be a kind of a program, although it might be just something that they need more time with, or a double dose, which is really what LLI becomes. And then you've got that small group up at that top, that Tier 3. So we look at that data from the reading improvement, and if they're not making progress, after a while, a decision is made that they need something more intense. And you can see it could be on an individual basis, they could need more of it, or they need something different, and sometimes a little bit more restrictive. But that's the typical kind of pyramid model that we see with RTI and the different tiers. This next slide really shows you kind of what the former process of really the identification of for kids to receive special ed services to what it looks like now under the RTI model. And I'm just going to highlight a couple of them. The old process, it was a wait-to-fail approach. We often didn't identify kids. You know, we used to say, oh, it's developmental, give them time, we'll see what happens. So we weren't even really looking at kids till about second grade, and by then it's sometimes too late. But it was a discrepancy. We needed to have that discrepancy to be able to say they're not where their peers are as well. And it was very referral-driven. We did one kid at a time, and you had 60 days to do it. And that's a long time that you're just kind of waiting to get to it or to do it. And the other thing is that last bullet point, which is has been, you know, special ed, and I'm a former special ed teacher in that, but it's that Hotel California. You have so many kids check in, and too few or nobody ever checks out. I mean, it was like a life sentence. Once you got in special ed, you were there forever. So we've kind of learned from those mistakes, which is kind of where we landed with RTI. So the biggest difference is that the RTI is really to catch them before they fail. You intervene early. You monitor that data, you make decisions, and you do something at that time as opposed to waiting. And the beauty of it would be that you catch kids, you give them what they need, and they're either back in the classroom or that's what they continue to need for a while. The bigger difference, though, is that special ed was always kind of a place. Once they were identified, then you know, you kind of thought they went somewhere and somebody kind of fixed them or worked with them. And it's really not about a place. It's about a service. It's about giving them what they need.
Karen, what role, and maybe Stacy, you know this, you know, being on the ground, what role do parents play? Is there a different role that they play with RTI than they did in the old model in terms of identifying early with teachers, coming to you? When you were assistant principal at Churchill full-time, you did all that work. So I'm curious how this is communicated to parents and how they partner in, you know, in any of this.
Well, the basis of a lot of this is when students are identified as needing more of that Tier 2 intervention, the parents are brought in and communicated with right away that something a little bit different is going on with their student. With LLI, the parents are made aware and they have decided that students are needing that. But even more so, there should be a more often communication between the teachers and the parents.
Parents, yeah. Between teacher and parent, yeah.
There might even be part of the process occurring at home. Mm-hmm. So parents may have a more defined role earlier in the process.
Mm-hmm. And when we're doing the problem solving, they would be at the table as well,
right,
to kind of know what that data is. I would say our biggest struggle right now is that parents still understand the old system. Mm-hmm. So they'll go out and have testing done, and they bring it, and even private psychologists are still kind of identifying under the discrepancy model. Mm-hmm. So that's been hard to kind of transition.
I think that's why I bring it up, because I know even in last year I would get an email or a call from a parent, who should I talk to? I have this testing done, but it's too long a time frame. You know, you mentioned the 60 days, and I know that's been on your table in terms of wanting to, you know, tighten that up. We heard some of that at Lend with some of the other issues going on. With RTI too, so I just think this is what we're doing now is a great opportunity to say to parents, this is in partnership. It's not just going to happen here, but when they go home, and the homework and all this other stuff has to follow this model, or like you said, if it's not aligned, it's a waste of time on some level because it's not connected to the way they learn or whatever.
So what we're doing now is when parents come in with those doctor reports, we're sitting down with them and we're explaining the process and we're developing a plan for that child within the regular ed RTI intervention model. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's an big education.
It's huge, yeah. Because there's still that, but this is what the doctor said, and this is what they need. And what we're doing is wanting to really align it to our general education and be more a part of the larger picture. So that's helpful for me or any of us, I think, if we get emails or calls. And
go ahead.
I'm not sure I'm catching the catch them before they fail. What is the actual mechanism that's different today than any kid that would come into our school that we felt was struggling?
In District 41, we've had the reading improvement services and that, and it was just kind of for those gen ed kids that who were struggling, we would have done things. This kind of formalizes that process a little bit more, but it's to ensure that all districts now are intervening early. And when I said that wait to fail approach was that whole concept of we waited till about second or third grade because you did this formalized testing, you plotted it out, and you needed to demonstrate that there was a discrepancy between the norm and where they were, and you had to show like two standard deviations.
So you almost had to fail before you could get services.
Right.
And you had to show to whom? You had to show to whom?
So this is more about
testing. Right.
I mean, if I had a kindergartner coming in, mm-hmm, and they didn't know that you read left to right, or if they were from another country, right to left, or whatever, we would have identified that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, are you saying, though, that...
We identify that in the fall, right, when they get...
So you would have identified that regardless of this, and what you're saying, though, is for us to intervene, we would have intervened at the classroom level, mm-hmm, and there would have been a process, maybe after another year, we realize the child isn't picking up that you read left to right, or... You know, and then it's parents come and they ask for something or they have a special test on. This is that process to get in there to get the intervention. That's the difference.
It maybe is that another process of support has been put in place, as well as another layer of expectation that testing is not the only way that you determine whether a child is going to need other services, that it is response to instruction. So if my instruction is not proving successful with a particular child, then I might say, why not? What does this child need? And instead of going to the student services team or the special ed group, what their role is to identify that a student, in fact, has a learning disability, we go to another level first to say among colleagues, with other groups of experts, maybe some members of that team who come out and help determine what other strategies a teacher might use. So it's more based in what can I do as a classroom teacher to provide appropriate instruction to children before we go into a formalized testing.
So but isn't that what differentiation was supposed to be?
Well, I'd say yes in the ideal world. This is probably much more intense than that. Differentiation, as we may have identified and used it, is I've got a group that's, you know, doing something over here, and they're the bluebird group. And now we have another group over here that is the, you know, soaring eagles. This is much more individualized than
so
that.
So there's no mechanism that says, I'm just stuck on the phrase, catch them before they fail. There's no mechanism or new test or something new that says, oh, I caught someone. It's now I have somewhere else to go to try different strategies to help
it. Well, and part of it is an expectation that wasn't there before.
Okay.
The expectation prior to RTI mandate was that you leave it to the special educators to fix it rather than it really being placed in the classroom teacher level.
That and or, you know, they were kind of struggling in kindergarten, so they were getting reading improvement. They're still struggling in first grade, and they're getting reading improvement, but they really need something more, but they're not discrepant enough yet, so they just kind of kept getting this one thing, when in fact, if they could have accessed something more intense, which may be something that's used in special ed earlier, we haven't waited as long, and hopefully we can.
So what is, you know, what does struggling mean? If I came in as a kindergartner and, you know, I'm in second, so I get this intervention, I go to first grade, I'm still struggling, I'm still at the kindergarten level, I go to second grade, I'm still at the kindergarten level. Do we hold kids back? Do we ever hold someone back and say, you know, maybe you should stay in first grade another year? I mean, is that an intervention strategy, or is that frowned upon these days?
I mean, occasionally, we would hold a child back, and you know, you don't want to just—it's not about social promotion. But hopefully, I mean, we would say, you know, if a child comes into us, they don't know their letters and sounds, and that we want our kindergartners to leave kindergarten reading at what we call a level C. So if they end kindergarten and they're still at like a level A, we would continue to target them or ratchet it up for what we're doing, because that means they probably know their letters and sounds, but they haven't put it together.
Which could be just developmental, and they'll catch it a little bit later, or it could mean that there is going to be a problem down the road.
But chances are they need more than what the classroom can give, teacher can give them within that literacy block,
right,
which is often referred to as, you know, a double dose. The other thing, too, that the whole RTI can target specific things. One of the things we've learned with our ELL kids in particular is they're great word readers, but they struggle with comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to work on everything. You could focus just on that comprehension piece. The same thing with math. So a child might not need it for everything or forever, but they just need, maybe it is fact fluency. You do some things to get them there. So that they are more fluent with their facts, and then they can kind of hang in there with their grade level peers.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be something more than that.
Something else that this process has forced us to do is really look at data and progress monitor kids. Whereas previously we would try different things and say, well, I think this might work, and I think he's doing better with this, but we never had anything to quantify that, whereas we are really focusing now on data, progress monitoring, and to see, are we closing that gap? Is that child making progress? And if they are continuing to make progress with what we're doing, then we keep doing it. But we're really forcing those data conversations that we haven't necessarily done in the past. So we really are getting, I think, a better handle on how our kids really are doing, what kind of progress they really are making. Is that what we want to see with them? So the conversations that we've been having have been great. They really force teachers to think and to determine different ways to work with their kids within the classroom and as a grade level team, not just as individual mm-hmm. teachers, but with that teaming approach as well.
And that's a great segue to the next slide, too. So, that general process is we do have the universal screening of literacy and math. We're using the MAP test. We have the Fountas and Pinnell, which is common, twice a year, and then we use the ISIL test that I referred to earlier at K and 1.
And that universal screening allows us to compare kids to their kind of typically developing peers. Again, that first best instruction is critical, and we identified kind of those non-negotiables in the literacy and math block and shared those with classroom teachers. And we have to show evidence that first best instruction is occurring for a child to ultimately be eligible for special ed services. That data analysis piece, and Stacy jump-started all of the buildings and worked with them.
First best instruction, can you define that term?
It's really that core curriculum, our gen ed curriculum, what occurs, is, and that it's being implemented with fidelity. So within the literacy block, we should see all of those components in adequate time. Kids need to be getting guided reading, and if they're struggling, they should get it every day. Mm-hmm. So all of those pieces of the block are in there, and there's like five components of literacy that have to be addressed, and there's five components of math that need to be built into that. So we just have to ensure that they're getting it, because you can't, it's not the fault of the child if they haven't been instructed. It's kind of that.
And then I'll jump a little ahead. In Tier 1, other than differentiated instruction, what other responses are there? I mean, what other choices are there besides differentiated instruction in the Tier 1 group?
Well, there's probably a lot of facets of that. The example would be what I just gave you, is you have guided reading groups. If you have kids who are reading above grade level, you probably only need to meet with that group 2 to 3 times a week because they're more independent and can do things. Kids who are struggling, you may need to meet with every single day to be sure they're doing that reading. You might do some other things, like in math. You might put them on the fast math or the fast fluency every single day for those kids who aren't getting it where other kids might not need it. So those would kind of be pieces of it. Stacy, can you think of any other specific examples teachers have talked about?
Within Tier 1, one of the things that we're talking about with math specifically is guiding math groups within the math block. That could be considered a Tier 1. That's every student has access to that, but at different levels. So it's taking the core curriculum, but maybe delivering it in a different way to those kids who might need that differentiated delivery. Mm-hmm. And it's not something outside of what every other student would be getting, which would be getting more into those tier two interventions.
Another example might be, too, when teachers were to look at their math data and they might see that their whole class is weak in a particular strand, they may kind of set their instruction up a little bit differently so that they can target that or hit a little bit harder, then do some assessing to make sure that they're making progress and mm-hmm. things like that. Or that would be something they might talk about with their grade level peers. How are you doing this? Those kinds of things.
That's the part that was puzzling me. If you're talking about whole group instruction, then you change the way you're instructing because clearly someone's not getting it. How do you know you didn't just lose 5 others that were getting it,
right?
You know, but now you've changed your method of instruction and now you're losing those 5, but you've got these 5 back, you know, how do you, and it sounds like that's why I'm differentiated instruction jumps out as an obvious intervention in Tier 1, and I was just wondering what else is there in Tier 1 that you can do besides that,
And a lot of it will occur in that small group instruction as well.
Differentiation gives you a lot of options on how to do
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would assume it's the primary strategy.
Karen, is there a number, when you're looking and assessing the data for a group of students, I mean, is it, you know, we can only have 5 kids, so we can only have 5 kids? I mean, my sense was Pris. That was the way it was with Pris. You could only have a certain number of kids, mm-hmm. and so kids who knew just enough couldn't be part of the program, even though they should have.
What they're really trying to do is find, is once they target those kids who are at the 30th percentile and below, what are the things they might need? And between the 10th and the 30th would be kind of Tier 2, but if they start out the year at below the 10th percentile, you're already looking at a Tier 3 type intervention, something more intense, more individualized. But when they did the data meetings, they looked at kind of the big picture of the child, because what we did find, as I mentioned before, is a lot of our lowest kids
would fall into multiple subgroups. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of look at, okay, what are they getting maybe within special ed? What do they maybe need to do differently? Maybe it could be different materials. It could be one-on-one.
Well, and I guess it's the question. I'm not sure if Steve, that was kind of what he was going for in the beginning. Is, you know, you're saying 30%, and we're looking at 30% at a national average. Our kids aren't that 30%. I mean, this district has a tendency to have kids who are well out of that. So you're really looking at maybe a 5%, 5 to 6% of our kids really kind of fall in that.
Well, it looks like we have about 216 kids in this program.
Well,
are you looking at summer school day?
It's different.
Yeah, the
last class. And I guess there are
about
I'm
9 kids per grade level.
In summer school?
No.
Oh, for the.
But that's only K-5, too.
K-5, right. So yeah. 4 buildings, 6 grades, 6 times 9 times 4. That's what it, I mean, that's yeah. The number that jumps out at me. Is that
but I, you know, and but I would tell you, in some of our buildings, like we had one particular grade level where there, I think there were like 24 kids below the 30th percentile at a particular building. So what are we going to do to meet,
right.
to meet their needs? And so you look at all of your resources. You know, the other thing we want to be careful about, too, is you start fragmenting the day for some of your most at-risk kids, you know, and you got to... You want to be sure it's aligned because you don't want the special ed teacher doing one thing, mm-hmm. the reading assistant doing another thing, and the gen ed teacher doing something else, and you know, the most at-risk kids are.
Which is why the DLT time has been an important component to help keep that unified and aligned. And of that 200 students, remember, some of those students may come in and out. They don't necessarily stay in reading improvement for the whole year. They may yeah. only have a short-term intervention.
I mean, just the number mm-hmm. of kids that would be. Mm-hmm. So what does this 3-to-1 mean? This means...
One teacher for 3 students.
One teacher for 3 students for how long? An hour a day? Or
it's 30 minutes.
Per day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's during the normal literacy block?
They try not to take them out of the literacy block. They want it to be that additional dose of it. So it occurs, it's been occurring within that targeted learning time of 30 minutes when everybody's doing something.
So it, they'll consistently pull them out of the same thing, or they consistently pull them out of different things?
They pull them out of that chunk of time where...
That's already set aside.
It's general
differentiation.
It's the TLT time.
Right. It's already set aside for gifted differentiation, this type of differentiation, tier two, whatever it is, mm-hmm. it's sacred time to have so they get what they need.
Right.
So they're not taking them out of math, they're not taking
days.
Them out of whatever.
Correct.
So how do we staff that?
We have the reading assistants. I mean, we've also trained our special ed staff and our ELL staff in the use of the LLI materials for an additional strategy for them kind of in their toolbox as well. But it's really delivered. And some of our special ed assistants are training as well.
And is this very grade dependent? In other words, you know, I noticed, you know, it's by grade. So,
we pull
you know,
by
let's,
grade
say you, let's say you took K through 3 and you had 15 kids at, you know, 28% and 15 at 15% or whatever. I mean, can you group them that way or do you need to keep them in grade?
You could group them that way, but because the building schedules have been designed to create that targeted learning schedule, we're not putting
level.
Them cross grade level. They're by grade level.
You could, but
you
the,
could.
The structure currently in place doesn't allow.
Because it's really about their reading level,
mm-hmm.
where they're at, that the instruction's occurring.
Karen, kind of go back to John's question about kind of back of envelope, how many children are in this program. I think John's number makes sense at the 216. Are we tracking that number? Are we tracking it on a monthly or a weekly basis to know who's in the you know, what are the numbers of children that are in the program and how is that trending?
The kids that are in the program are progress monitored on a regular basis, and then the literacy specialists at each building meet and regularly, probably though more monthly, I would say, to be able to say who's making progress, because we kind of work from a chart that shows us where at each grade level about the kids should be reading. and make decisions about who exits and who enters. But that's one of the things that we learned when we tried to pull the data, is pulling it out of the data warehouse didn't give us what we were looking for. So we need to create a different sort of data collection tool. I mean, at the end of the year, we could tell you how many kids receive services. But there's other factors, you know, we're a little leery about, because, like, as I said, you know, we had some special ed kids also getting it because the reading assistant was available, but in another building we couldn't pull those kids because there wasn't enough slots for them. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of inconsistent based on the needs of the school.
So you couldn't tell me month over month who's in the number of kids that are in the program?
No, we could tell you just a strict number of kids, but I don't know that that's the best data we want to know, just how many kids are receiving services because of some of those other factors.
We want to know who's receiving them and how they're progressing.
Correct. And at each school, they're keeping that data.
But what you're telling me is that the number of kids and how they're progressing is somewhat nebulous because of these other factors, so you can't really give me a clear number.
Well, we our goal is to figure out a better way to really get that data, to look at it more from a district perspective.
Right. The schools have it.
The schools have that data and easy access to it, but it's trying to kind of pull it all together that it's not as clean as we'd like it to be.
So the data is there, but it's very local to the school. There's not a way Karen can just go in and pull it, which is what Nancy discovered when she went in to pull it, that what we're getting is not what we really need.
Well, it shows the complexity, again, of our student population. And as you said at the beginning of the presentation, that we have children who are in multiple, potentially multiple groups. And so that, I'm trying to think about this from a teacher perspective and how complex this is. And thinking, Stacy, this is your first year in this position, and how this whole year on some level has probably been trying to figure out what's the best way to do everything.
Absolutely.
You know, and one of these things is the data pull. And if Nancy can't figure it out...
Well, Nancy can figure it out. She just didn't have it. She couldn't get it.
We didn't like the data. I mean, because I didn't feel like it was the right data that we were really looking for.
Right.
Now, we'll go back. We have our mid-year kind of checkpoint with MAP in January. So then they'll look at that. Mm-hmm. Who are those kids that were targeted in the fall? Are they, you know, who's made progress? Who's moved out of that 30th percentile? That's one data point. But we'll also still monitor what their reading level is, because that's a closer correlation to how they're performing.
It ties into the boards in each of the schools and how they're progressing, moving those cards forward, quote unquote, to get them to, you know, whatever it is at or beyond reading level.
That's where the data is.
So they're a part of that whole,
In general, are kids entering and exiting all the time, or is it kind of quarterly or semesterly that kids are going to be in or out? Or
We used to really kind of give them the year. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just weren't moving them out. So now, because we progress monitor on a regular basis, they'll move kids as soon as they're ready. So we've had some kids who have been out within 6 weeks, others 2 or 3 months, but we've already had kids this year who have exited.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking tier two, right?
Tier two. Right. In other words, they kind of, they intervened, they kind of got them back on track. They're just back into Tier 1 in the Gen Ed classroom.
Okay, so we consider every kid in Gen Ed in Tier 1?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That's the Gen Ed pop.
Yeah.
And I know you're focusing on the elementary, but I'm just, in my head, I'm thinking about Hadley, and I know we've had the presentation from Hadley and Jeannie Shue talking about the math and how we've done. I mean, is it similar where we have kids entering and exiting at Hadley in the same type of process, or, I mean, it's really that different there?
Well, because it's structured through those academic support classes, because I was going to say it's kind of more like a year, but last year they exited kids after the January data came.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. That was what I remembered that was the point, was to get them in, get them solid, and get them out.
And student progress monitoring, which is another data point they're looking at BLT, would be in and out. I mean, the student progress monitoring is a different it would be a tier two intervention for students arranged around the teachers. So a student could stay in that progress monitoring until a set of assessments is able to determine that the child's made progress.
I mean, and isn't that the whole point of these programs, is to get them in and get mm-hmm. them out?
And they had moved kids out. And I think what it helped from the Hadley kids' perspective is they thought differently about when they took that MAP test, because some of them didn't realize they would end up in academic support based on that MAP test. And so when they were there, and it was really,
take it more seriously.
Take it more seriously. And we saw some kids who, really did beautifully, and we were able to move them out. And, you do want to target the right kids.
Right.
And hopefully you can get some other data, too, that would tell you whether they need it or not. So.
You should let her finish the presentation.
I'm sorry.
I have a question. Back to the data implications, though. I mean, that's really where, we'll hope that our technology group can step up and put something together to help you guys track this better, right?
At a district level.
On the building level, I'm much more confident because, that was one of the shifts. When Judy moved to Hadley, I really needed each of the literacy specialists to kind of maybe take a greater role in what was happening at the building, because Judy used to try to monitor that from here. And since when she went to Hadley, to really have that connection. And that's really helped because it's given the building more ownership. And then they had to make some decisions.
Because, next sort of data question is, you say students previously receiving services have continued to make steady improvement. Okay, but I would assume any kid going through our system is going to make steady improvement. So how do you, not that you can't maybe scientifically do this, I don't know, but how do you think about, was the intervention such that they really made more improvement had they not been in the program? So,
well, and that's one of the things we like to look at, kind of their growth target. Did they meet their growth target? Those kind of things. And I had Nancy go back and kind of color coordinated as well. And you saw them moving more from the red into the kind of the yellow, and some kids were in the green, which is where we would want them to be. One of the things we noticed is they may not be, though, at now the 60th percentile, but they've moved above the 30th percentile. Would we like them higher? Absolutely. So we want to keep.
So your conclusion based on this is that they are making more of an improvement with the intervention than they would under the general ed tier one.
Well, without it, I would think the gap would probably continue to widen because they're not getting enough of what they need. I go back to emphasize, too, why LLI in particular people are very fond of is it does align well with the core curriculum. And that's always been kind of a personal concern of mine, and having taught it, is that sometimes the more you remove a child from access to general education materials and the curriculum, is the gap just gets wider and wider, and by the time you try to get them back to access it, they've been away from it for so long. They look great in the special ed room with special ed materials, and you think they're ready to go back, and they don't make it because they haven't been closely connected to the gen ed curriculum.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I think we've learned in special ed over time. So you want to keep them as closely connected to the tier one as possible. But this just kind of takes you through it. I mean, the nice thing about having had the PLC up and running for a year is it provided that venue really for Stacy to kind of come in and meet with those grade level teams to do that data analysis. She'll go back and do another check-in mid-year, end of the year. But they set the goals, they're reviewing progress. If they're making progress, you may continue with the intervention. If they've made more than enough progress, you could move them back to tier one. Or if they're not making progress, you may go to tier three. You will ratchet it up a little bit. But they continue to progress monitor them. They meet with the specialists at the building on a regular basis to kind of talk about that. And they're, the specials are the link between those reading improvement teachers and the classroom teachers, because the reading improvement assistants aren't at the table when they're doing the collaboration. And so you'd follow that through even with Tier 3 as well. So
I don't get to individual until Tier 3.
You know what?
Or that's just a general rule and some.
It usually is Tier 3. But keep in mind, too, you might have some kids who started this year right at Tier 3. You know, they were below the 10th percentile, and that's what they needed. You know, and some might get a small group and then another individual to fill in different gaps. You know, you really kind of look at what they need. But this is kind of that final process for it. So Stacy facilitated that initial meeting, those ongoing meetings, the grade level PLCs and the developmental specialists review that data, the use of the targeted learning time, and then other staff resources is really at that time when they're addressing those other intervention needs. And by that, I mean what the buildings did is they looked at some of their special ed aides, and maybe when the one-on-one aides and when that child was with a special ed teacher, they then used that aid to provide interventions for kids at other grade levels, you know, other classrooms, things like that. And in some cases, the special ed teacher will take a group of kids. She's already working with kids on, you know, a particular a skill or whatever it happened to be. So some of those kids during that time will join that special ed group. Which, you know, years ago was like unheard of. They could never, you know, you couldn't work with a special ed teacher if you didn't have that label and that. Mm-hmm. So
it was illegal.
Well, yeah, it was. So we're becoming more flexible. And then the school psychologists are also helping support the process on site. Their role has definitely changed. They used to test. They did all the formal assessments that were required in part of special ed. Now it's that facilitating, helping facilitate that RTI process, because it's really about the data and the progress kids are making, even within special ed, that they're looking at, as opposed to a battery of tests and whatever, you know, that discrepancy. So again, you know, it's the first year of rolling it out there. It's really a learning year. We'll continue to make modifications. You know, it feels new to teachers, but in some respects, having implemented targeted learning last year, it kind of was a nice transition mm-hmm. for them. So, kind of quickly with summer school here, this just kind of highlights really what we offered. If you recall, this past summer was the first summer we did our own summer school program, and it was for kids entering first through eighth grade. So they had just finished kindergarten, and they had just finished seventh grade. We had that one multi-age bilingual. We had pre-identified kids using winter data, and we strictly use those data points for identification. And Lucy Dahlman was our director of summer school, and her and I really sat down, we looked at the data, sent it to the buildings to verify, that sort of thing. And we're making some changes to that this year as well. We did the 3 weeks in June and the 2 weeks in August. The idea was to kind of keep them going and then jumpstart them in August. And we're going to be changing that too. You'll see kind of why, basically. If you recall, we talked, I don't remember, I think we've talked about this, but I don't know anymore, but the elementary day was longer in June only because we did that science enrichment component, and they loved it. So it was a long day, but and that was just at the elementary, so our Hadley kids just had 3 hours kind of both sessions, and that, and Hadley was at Hadley, and elementary was at Franklin last year. You can see up there that a fourth of the kids never came back in August. So we weren't able to jumpstart them, basically. And we knew some of the kids weren't coming back, but we lost a fourth of the kids that we expected to come back, which, you know, they had great smaller class sizes, but that was concerning, so we're going to make a change with that. And you can see how class sizes we projected at 20, but they ended up being smaller.
What was the total population?
I'd have to look at my total on that chart there. If you look at that,
it's the
number of students if you total it up down there.
So 55, something like that, yeah.
So we did survey the teachers, though, just to kind of get their feedback. And if you remember, we did run that science enrichment camp in Mandarin Chinese as well. So you can see the teacher survey, the pluses. They loved the science curriculum. We had limited the number of camp invention kids that could attend, and that was helpful because it was at the same site, and it was a little crazy that week. And lots of boys.
And camp invention is a separate...
It was, it was a week-long
enrichment program.
They had great snacks, and the reason for the thanks for letting us have a recess built in is I had told them no recess because it was 4 hours and, you know, these kids are behind, we got to, you know, use our time wisely. And my fear was if you shut down for recess, you're going to lose a whole half hour. So they told me, though, this was just in August because, you know, it was lower key, not as many kids or whatever. So anyway, but that was a big deal to them because they did get a little bit of a recess. But, so we'll see where we land on that. The idea was that that hands-on science was their break. But we did make sure they had, you know, plenty of materials and supplies, and we targeted things specific to that. And Kathy Maxson was the summer school secretary, and Lucy was the director. So you can kind of read those deltas up there for yourself. Even though the first session was too long, they loved the science, and they wouldn't want to give it up. So we will keep that. They would love the teacher ratio to be 1:8, but that would be very expensive. And we, you know, we talked a little bit about that too. So it won't be that small. The consideration of better places for IEP students. If kids are eligible for K summer school, they're not a candidate for our summer school. Mm-hmm. And we had a few kids that were misplaced last year, and that was a struggle. So we're going to do that. The other big piece too is that. We want to have more teacher involvement in that identification process as well. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. That's one of the recommendations in that. But if you can see the summary data for this, it's basically baseline data. What I had been hoping for, or what I was trying to look for, was a correlation between attendance and showing growth, that kind of thing. And I defined... And it was somewhat arbitrary on my point, but they really only, even though it was 5 weeks, it was 20 days. So that's not a lot. So good attendance was they came 17 to 19 days, and I thought average attendance was like 14 to 16, and poor attendance was anything under 13 days. I mean, if you miss that much, you know, you're kind of hardly there kind of thing. But what I was really hoping for was that if they had good attendance, you know, but if you look at the eighth grade group at the bottom there, now there's only seven kids. None of them had good attendance, but 57% of them showed growth in reading and 43% showed growth in math. So my theory, what I was hoping for, you know, didn't kind of show there. But, you know, the other thing is I try to just kind of form these hypotheses is the kids at the junior high are not as discrepant as your elementary kids. Mm-hmm. So that's a factor. When I presented this data at the buildings, one of the teachers who's working on her doctorate said, you know, just research will say in general, all kids regress over the summer. It's just how quickly they can recoup that. And so you may not see growth even from a typically developing child and not worry too much about it. But even if they did lose ground, that would be great. The one that I was mostly concerned about is if you look at that second grade, and these would be kids who started their second graders this fall. That was our largest group of, almost our largest group of kids who attended. And if you look at that's the group that showed the least amount of growth in both reading and math. But it's also the same grade level that shows the least amount of growth district-wide. And the reason is that the math test changes the beginning of second grade. They no longer take the math for primary, which has an auditory support. They take the 2 through 5 regular survey with goal test that the other kids take. And so all of our second graders tend to dip in the fall just because we've removed the auditory support for them. But then they're the group that makes the most growth over the course of the year as well.
This is spring to fall growth?
It's spring to fall. And, you know, in a perfect world, I had originally said, oh, I think, you know, we want the teachers to make sure everybody gets a running record and that kind of thing. And
in 20 days, I mean, you know, that all they could do was be assessing. So that's where we just landed on we would use the...
When is the fall tested?
We start, like, right after Labor Day, Mike? Yeah.
So it's pretty quick after.
It's pretty quick. Now, some of the kids may not get it till the end of the window, which might be later on in September, but that's usually our younger kids who take it a little bit later. They get the older kids in there.
Well, I think we heard multiple times that all kids lose it over the summer, regardless of...
So hopefully we can keep them from losing too much.
Just like board members over the summer.
But anyway, it's good. It's baseline data. And again, we want to flag the kids in CERS now so that we can continue to see who might be our kind of frequent flyers in summer school, if they're coming every year, that sort of thing.
Just quickly, Karen, how much support did you get from parents, and how do we raise the bar for parents to get their kids here and get them back in August?
Well, Mike, you can kind of go to the next slide, too, as well, because it's really a little bit of the recommendation. We started and we used winter data, and last year we started with kids who were at the 30th percentile, and then some of those kids showed enough growth that we didn't really need them to attend summer school, and I had some parents who had still wanted them to come, even though they were letting out like the 50th percentile, even though, which caused even greater discrepancy with our group. You had some kids at the second percentile, and other kids were at the 40th percentile. Mm-hmm. So we've tightened that up a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think the other, you know, in all fairness, we've kind of given them that date. I was probably more flexible because I just wanted to at least come for some of it. Some parents had already made
plans
and things like that. So this year, I want to do a stronger letter that really says, you know, your child currently is probably performing below the 50th percentile. They're being recommended for summer school. This is what needs to happen, mm-hmm. kind of for them not to attend. Like mandatory, but we can't really make them come.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of... We'll choose our words carefully.
Sure.
But, you know, on the other side of that, we had kids at Hadley who just came because other kids got on the bus and they came with them and decided to come to summer school.
Can't quite know.
We'll take them. That, right. And so, you know, that happened as well. It happened at both the elementary and mm-hmm. at Hadley as well. So
do you think the location of the program has anything to do with who attends?
I mean,
you know, cross town, you know, last year it was at Ben Franklin, next year it's going to be at Churchill.
We bussed.
Right.
No, I remember. And we connected with the Resource Center, and we did make decisions about who should go to the Resource Center and who went to summer school. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll have to see. I mean, the other thing we're doing
sounds
is...
Sounds like the snacks were more important.
The snacks were important. Yeah, and for the kids, I mean, that was a big deal. But we are going to do 5 weeks, and we're going to change it to kind of the end of June through July. Our neighboring districts offer it that time. And so hopefully, if we can get them to commit, I mean, we had so many just fall off in August. And you know what? As a parent, I understand that. You kind of get into... another routine, and I don't want to go back, you know, so you just...
Well, it gives them the ability to have a month off with a vacation, right?
Right, you know, before they kind of come right. back in that.
And so they're coming back in August anyway.
Right. So we're shifting the time frame. We are going to make it a 4-hour day for everybody. And Lucy and I are meeting with Christina this week to try to build a kind of like a nice technology enrichment for the older kids. We could expand the science, so we'll kind of play with that, but we thought if we could really grab them with kind of a neat technology piece, that would be another reason kind of why they would want to come.
You're going to do the camp intervention, I mean the other enrichment program?
Yes, but we're going to separate it at a different school. That'll be at Forest Glen, so then we can extend that enrollment just for week last year. But we're going to put all of the kids at Churchill. And, you know, we've gone back and forth because, you know, does Hadley kids don't want to be in an elementary school or whatever. But it was just hard. You know, we don't want to have two directors. And so it was hard for Lucy to kind of be in both places. And, you know, the first day, the kids just, you know, dismissed themselves. And, you know, we're kind of running down the hall. And so we just need kind of tighter
tighter control. So I think it'll just be better if they're all at one location. And we heard that from a lot of teachers, although I think the sixth graders kind of liked that introduction and exposure to Hadley, having been there for that little summer before everybody else. But so, you know, again, in their second year, we'll get that. But we are going to try to do maybe some grade level groupings to allow for more of the leveling. Kind of, John, what you were talking about. You know, you don't have to be in second grade if this is your level. Because the other thing is, because we're doing the busing, you can't just be there for reading or for math. Most kids need both, but we have some that don't need one. If they don't need the math, the program we're using would allow us to almost do some extensions of some of their number sense in certain areas. So we'll have kind of greater flexibility with it if we do some groupings in that. The one thing I didn't mention earlier, we had literacy teachers and we had math science teachers. So the kids had two teachers, and then that allowed the teachers to focus on certain subject areas. And we're going to continue with that. The teachers really like that. So this year, there'll be a math technology teacher and a reading teacher. The other thing we did in June was we continued to offer the reading intervention as another dose to that. So the kids rotated out for an extra half hour. We're going to expand that for all kids to get something else, and the teachers really liked it. But we're increasing the involvement of teachers in the identification process. They will kind of fill out a form that'll travel with the child, and then the summer school teacher will get it and provide information back, just so that they're more in the loop and they're more involved in the process. And that will help with the communication with parents. Because I had a few parents who were surprised, you know, that their child wasn't doing well and things like that. So I wanted to make sure the teachers have had some kind of contact with the parents as well. And then, again, we'll give those teachers feedback. Because, you know, they're coming back to a new teacher. A, they may not have even known they went to summer school. And then B, you know, how they did or what they did. And so that if the interventions need to continue, they know where they left off. And then teachers can kind of just pick up with them. So... the next steps, I think that's the last slide here, which we've really talked a lot about, was developing that systematic approach to really the identification, data collection, progress monitoring with our reading improvement. And that's really more from a district perspective. It's happening at the building. Look at what that appropriate allocation of staff to do needs-based rather than just everybody gets three people. We'll start to have those conversations with building principals. Continue to monitor the progress. We'll build the RTI model. We need to continue to look for opportunities and time for math intervention, because that has still been a struggle. You know, targeted learning time is, some buildings are choosing to do math, and Stacy mentioned guided math, but we've identified some good resources, and a lot of the grade level teams are starting to think outside the box how to give kids something extra in the area of math. But that's an area where we really want to continue to focus on. And then we're going to expand the PBIS. We're starting with that and get that up and running. And it'll be a nice, you know, as we get the work of the group who's looking at bullying and math, how does it all kind of fit together? And continue to monitor all program data, and then to make the stronger links to both the program and the support of Hadley. You know, if kids have had these kind of interventions, Kathy knows what works, those kinds of things. And you know, one of the other things, too, we talked a little bit about parents, and Stacy's, you know, working on a parent pamphlet for RTI as well that kind of helps explain it and will help educate them as we transition into a different way of identifying kids. So.
All right. Any questions?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'll say it again, but you know, when I see this model here, I kind of go back to my philosophy. I juggle on a good artist I am. I'd really like to start seeing this model, right? We're very good here in formalizing, as you said, the bottom percentage. It'd be nice to formalize the top percentage and the kids that are doing well and have more interventions for them. Our back-to-school program would be great to target, you know, some really high extracurricular activities and maybe science that targets those kids that just love science or great at science, and it's a different kind of intervention. And it'd be nice to see that. Or I know I remember last year there were discussions because of the schedule and the orchestra thing or the foreign language thing. There were some kids who maybe couldn't take a technology course that they wanted to take it because they were taking orchestra and language, and that stopped them from another extracurricular. And those would be great things to think about for summer, to offer up in some light, you know, so that those kids who really want to do that have a chance to do that. So I go back to, we're good at formalizing this stuff, but, you know, it'd be nice to just see in every single presentation, even if it's not formalized, that we're thinking about it.
Well, this is a presentation, though, about the lower half.
But
it, was, it always is, though.
District 87.
And have we taken a survey of where students go in the summer for private things
well,
to do
I was
this?
I mean, about
the district
it. It
doesn't have to do all these.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what how parents would access that or if they're already doing it on their own.
It may not even be of interest. I'm just saying that I don't know that we ever think about it.
You know what, though, John? I'm not going to disagree with your comment about doing more for the middle to the top half because I do tend to agree with you. In terms of the enrichment opportunities, though, they were there last year. I mean, the science program, I mean, as a parent, I was at Ben Franklin, and there were a million kids there. And so their opportunity, and the Chinese program, which I know my child's taking it again, it was an excellent, excellent program. Those are the programs for those students, and they were publicized. And I don't know what those numbers were, but on the flip side of that, a lot of parents actually take a step back and say, this is a time I'm not going to put my child in anything and let them enjoy the summer and go to the pool or do their sport camp or whatever it may be. I'm not disagreeing with you, though, John, about presenting those opportunities, but they really are there. And I mean, again, I know you said the science. I'm hoping the Chinese will be there because that was a phenomenal opportunity for just the kinds of students that you're talking about mm-hmm. and whether people access it. I agree. There are many private programs that are out there. I think a lot of people used to go to COD and take some of those. There's that one program that's in Wheaton, you know, because every child in Glen Allen is gifted, that all those gifted kids go to. We have those opportunities.
Well, and District 87 actually did a few things last year, and they sent the mailing directly.
Yeah,
from
right. It was great because there was some real connection.
Mm-hmm. Right, and they're going to continue. They want to continue to expand it. They are interested in really even kind of offering a summer school program that would target our middle school kids into high school, but it's still more in the planning phase, and we needed to be ready to move with something.
Again,
and I've talked to them about that, but they want to continue to offer those to all of the feeder school kids, mm-hmm. and so I would expect some other additional offerings because they're expanding as well.
And that's why we started with what we could do last summer, which was to build our own summer school program with an eye towards first intervention, but we added the enrichment opportunities for other students so that it was a start. And while we hosted them, we also allowed other companies to actually put them on because our capacity for doing all of that was not there. But so I think to say that we don't think about those
zero.
Students.
I'm not saying it's zero.
Well, and
I'm just saying it's not as formalized.
Right, and the degree to which you need necessarily to formalize what you call an extension, you're calling an intervention, is the extension is an opportunity, the intervention is a requirement in order to help students achieve at the same levels of their grade level peers. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
I mean, we have a different sort of...
we do. My requirement is to help every student
mm-hmm.
achieve to their capacity.
We agree.
I think
we agree. We agree. Karen, thank you.
Thanks, Karen. Thank you,
Stacy. Okay. Next up, superintendent's report.
I have just the enrollment report, which is there for you to look at, and just want to give you a heads up. This afternoon we had a water main break over at Churchill, which impacted our after-school programming there, and Bob did a great job of getting over there, seeing what was going on in the scene. The village has been there this evening getting that repaired. We expect that there won't be any problem, but we did move our Park District program from Churchill over to Forest Glen so that students had the ability.
It was on
Geneva or where?
It was right on, Geneva, the property.
It's actually on our property.
Okay.
Right where we've seen it bubbling up, but right next to the parking lot as you're turning right into the bus drop-off. Mm-hmm. But the main part of the parking lot. We noticed
it froze?
About 1 o'clock this afternoon, and at 4 o'clock the plumbers were just arriving.
We
so
know.
The repair will be on the district's
Okay, that's it for me.
Okay, next up we have board reports. Are there any members of the board wish to give a report at this time?
Well, Dan was going to give our policy committee report, so I'll just do it briefly. We met with Ann and Maureen Stecker on December 20th for an elongated meeting. I guess we were together for like 3 hours, which was actually very good. We had a lot to get through, and we'll be presenting coming in February updates to policy and also a review of FOIA. We looked again at the revenue and investments policy, so we'll do a read on that, and then some revisions to FMLA. So those are materials that Dan and I are looking over, and they'll come back to the board for a first reading. So we had a very good meeting, got a lot done, and we'll plan to present that. So it's good. And my only other one is board secretary is just to remind everybody, because I had to get an email out to my CERC representative, that we're on our December to February schedule. December to March schedule for PTA and all that. And it I'm not sure when PTA meetings are. I know they're starting again in January, but just to remind everybody to get that contact out to your liaison person so we can make sure we're at those meetings.
Finance committee, most of you were at the December 13th meeting. Where we landed was basically we're down to the B series, either large parcel building at building middle school, large part, or new K-5. We haven't eliminated Spalding. But we're kind of looking at that now as sort of a new K-5 or new middle school. And the committee can't decide between the two. So it's highly likely that your final recommendations first step will be for the board to decide which of those two to go with. But today we discussed kind of where we were at, what some of our short-term recommendations will be, and also discuss the preparation of the report and when we think we could have it. We think we'll have a pretty good draft by our next January meeting, but I think we want to move the presentation to the board into our first meeting in February, if that's okay with everybody.
Sure.
So sorry about the delay, but that's where we're going to move that to. So that's where we're at. If anyone wants to give any feedback on those two options to me or Drew or Ann or Bob, feel free. But we're kind of at a we can't come to a definitive decision on those two options. And so most of our short-term options will center upon, you know, making that decision as well as gathering other information, you know, needed to move forward.
Is that the decision? You're struggling to get to a decision because there's really not a true majority or consensus, or just one person thinks one way and one person thinks the other?
That one.
It's a committee of two.
Yeah.
You have two opinions.
So it's either that or flip a coin, and I thought that would trivialize the matter. So that's where we're at. And then also I want to report that I'm back and can now retake over the Pledge of Allegiance duties for Mr. Kenwood. He's getting a little too comfortable with
it. I don't know there's a policy that you get that automatically.
It's tradition.
I think it should be given by passion and belief.
All right. Okay, any other board reports? Okay. Next up are discussion items, and we have four of them. I didn't know, since we had a long presentation, if we wanted to get into the last one about accumulated fund balances, which could be a pretty open-ended discussion.
Did you want to tackle that tonight?
To move it to another date?
Yeah,
or
move it to another meeting.
I would certainly defer to Bob, who put that on the agenda.
Yeah, so it's kind of Bob's request. Bob Solak.
I'm okay with tabling it for the next meeting. That's fine.
Can we put it at the top of the discussion item?
We can. The next meeting is at Churchill, so there will be a presentation that evening.
But those tend not to be quite as long as our...
So it's fine. I just want to make sure that, you know...
Do we anticipate a large discussion item? I mean, I don't want to... This is something that's going to take a good discussion, and I don't want to cut it. I mean, I'm glad that Bob suggested that because I don't want to cut it, and it's, I feel like it's already getting late.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I would suggest, too, is that even a discussion at a regular board meeting of this topic is not going to probably be enough, and we may want to think about how you want to frame that, how much time you want to devote to it, and then what are the next steps, you know, so that, because I think you're probably going to need more discussion. May need a finance committee of the whole, which is what we've done in the past.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think maybe if we table this to the next meeting, put it at the top of discussion items, and then give it a certain framework of time, and then I think a next step should be that we come to committee of the whole to really then talk about what those suggestions or recommendations or options are.
Can we get the information that will be available at today's meeting, though?
Mm-hmm. So that we can give you, we can distribute that.
Yeah, in this way.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which is just information. It's
That's just good to have for the next.
Okay, and so we just have the three others. I'll let Ann kind of take us through those.
Well, the first one is our innovative modular solutions lease renewal, and innovative modular solutions is our leasing company for our portables. We have 20 portable classrooms that are up for renewal, and the recommendation is to, in fact, renew them with a 3-year lease beginning this upcoming August.
But we do have an opt-out, right?
We do have an opt-out for 2012. Should there be some reason to opt out, we felt that was a viable safety valve, not that we would need to use it, nor would there be an expectation by the leasing company that we would have to use it. But they were comfortable with giving that option, and it may be something that, as time goes on and if there's another renewal, that now the kind of the ice has been broken in terms of having an opt-out.
Right.
Bob, I just had two questions, and I apologize for not getting those to you today. But I just was curious, like, what? Why such a weird? I mean, fluctuation in terms of cost between the 3-4 classroom. I mean, is it just the
different sizes?
The difference. Okay.
Different sizes. Okay. And age.
Because I thought, I mean, I'm like, you know, what's $1,000 swing on something? But okay, and Forest Glen. I mean, I know the 1-2 classroom one. I'm trying to remember what grades were in there because I thought one of them had like the specialist for previously last year when we were there. And I know that that's
this year
by building and what goes in those. But I begs the question: is it still needed in that at site?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say yes, since there are no open classrooms in the building.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I would just like to caution the board also, though, that the portable classroom pod, if you will, that we have at Lincoln, the one that sits down behind the building, it's aging. And we're having, I've been called there a couple times for indoor air quality issues, HVAC issues, just a number of different situations that have arisen over the past year or so. So that may be one we're looking at. Eventually replace it.
And that's the one that's behind. That's not the nice one. That's
not
the one on the side.
No,
okay.
It's on
and
the,
that's
the north end of the building.
And it's one of the original. I mean, isn't that, is that one of the...
So
we
installed
it in 2003. Okay. But we bought
that used from another school district. So we own that one. So
what
does
what does that mean? It's ancient, because the recommendation here is to extend the lease, right?
Well, that,
not
that
one.
We own that one already.
We own that.
I was just making a general mention that is probably one that will need replacing in the short term versus the long term.
So we own the one that's behind the building.
That's correct.
So to get a new one, we potentially either purchase or, I mean, we would be leasing. So we the cost being incurred, cost of removal.
removal, and acquisition, reinstallation.
Okay. And is that one that had to have a special? I remember some that we had to get like special variants. I mean, I remember the one at Churchill that was like flown over the top of the building, and I thought there was, I thought one at Lincoln too had special variance issues.
What happened with the one at Lincoln is where we were originally wanted a place that we couldn't,
okay,
because of the setbacks.
Okay.
So we had to turn it a different way.
And
that was when it first came in. Okay. And we didn't fly anything over
I don't remember.
We talked about it where we wanted, we actually wanted to put it on the back playground, but you couldn't get there without
lifting it out.
That's why it's in the parking lot.
Yeah,
but that's the variation that we had at Lincoln was strictly the fact that we had originally planned to put it as one way, and the village came in and said no, you had to leave because of the back issues. So that's why we turned it, and that's why it's placed where it is.
So is the scope of this, I guess would be my question, and I'm just throwing out, if I'm not sure if we've decided that we don't want to own anymore, because we already own some, should we ask for a quote to replace the ones behind Lincoln and lease, and maybe because we're upping our lease here, maybe there's an advantage to that? Or?
I don't know that we're at the point yet where we need to actually look
To replace it. So we got 2 or 3 more years on replacing
it. I would think so.
But it's a caution.
I appreciate the heads up, though, because...
I just wanted to make mention that potential is out there. I've had meetings with the staff there on a couple of different occasions, and they're voicing concern to me, so I thought I would relay that message.
Well, if we continue without a plan to replace the portables, in the next few years, there'll have to be another plan. There'll be another plan to replace portables with portables.
Well, and it's just, again, and this was, has been brought up with the finance and facility meeting too, but it's part of our audit from the ROE. It's having a specific plan in place to get remove modular classrooms, and that's part of our audit from the regional office of that. So, I mean, I appreciate the heads up. This is, you know, it's a ticking.
Every year I have to sign a document that more or less attests to the fact that there's a plan in place to...
Right.
Rid the district of the portables.
Right. That's why this is such a critical conversation.
Okay. Any other questions on the portable, please? The next, I will be bringing that back for approval at the January 18th meeting. The next item for discussion is a request to have a resolution authorizing Franzik to intervene on our behalf in an appeal to the State of Illinois Property Tax Board. And this is really renewing a resolution that we've had in the past, but on occasion we have property tax appeals from commercial properties that we need to intervene because of potential loss of revenue to the school district. And this is one of those cases. Two pieces of property that just came in with tax appeals that could cost the district in back taxes we've already, revenues we've already received and had to,
well, it's really an expense
to go back.
It's not affecting revenues, it's an expense.
It's a cost,
right, it's a cost to us as well as future loss of revenues that we believe that substantial enough to intervene. We need attorney representation down in Springfield in order to do that intervention, and so we're asking that the board approve our resolution or enter into a resolution with Franzik to represent us in that property tax appeal case.
Is it just District 41 property, 89 and 87 are not affected by this?
87 is probably affected, but 89 would not be.
Okay.
Not to nitpick again, but does it really affect future revenues? I mean, if they go back and you have to pay them for it, when you come to the next levy, the fact that they got their assessment done, it just goes back in the pool, and we're still based off of last year's levy in dollars.
It just changes our rate slightly.
It's a tiny bit of the rate, but it doesn't really affect future revenues. It's really fighting...
But it would affect 2008, which has been paid.
Right. It
would affect our current expenditure.
Rates set after the dollars are determined.
But if it was just a reassessment for future, we might not care, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Other than to inequity thing for, you know, for commercial property versus residential.
Mm-hmm.
It's the loss. It's having the payback dollars we've already received. That's
right.
The problem.
Which would be over $100,000.
Right. I'm not saying we shouldn't do this, but just...
Is that $100,000 over 2 years?
The preliminary calculation I made last week was about $55,000 for this one particular year, 2008.
What?
So if they were successful for 2008, we're assuming they would be successful for 2009, and then however that rolls forward.
Mm-hmm. And is that for both properties, Bob?
Both properties, correct.
So it's $155,000.
For both pieces of property, approximately $55,000.
And do we have an estimate of what this will cost us?
You know, preliminarily, maybe 5 hours with the attorneys, 10 hours with the attorneys, and they're about $200 an hour.
Okay. Any other questions?
So the other item that we discussed in mm-hmm. finance about the intergovernmental agreement, mm-hmm. that won't come until next meeting?
We'll bring that next meeting. Just as a preview, what Bob is referring to is we are in conversations. We took to finance this evening conversations with our feeder districts to enter into an intergovernmental agreement surrounding all property tax appeals so that we would work as a consortia on those, using Franzek as the representing attorney, so that if District 87 was involved in a tax appeal that also involved District 41, we would do it together, which would reduce our attorney costs in any of those cases.
That's why I asked the question, because I wondered if we had common property.
And they may yeah. appeal as well, but in this particular case, because we don't have that intergovernmental agreement, we would each move forward separately.
And we discussed in finance talking to them mm-hmm. outside of the intergovernmental agreement, but this has to be done right away.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, this has to be filed by January. I'm sorry, Bob.
I'll place a call at the assistant superintendent of District 87 and give an answer regarding if they intend to.
Right.
Contest also.
So you will see a whole nother agreement related to property tax appeals that will be a different kind of agreement at our next meeting for discussion. Okay. The last discussion item is an item that I placed on, requested as Bob made a request to place on the agenda. I made a request to place this on the agenda, and perhaps it's just a review with the board in terms of our process for discussion and decision making and communicating with one another. I'm wondering if there hasn't been some confusion about how we process through information and how one or several of you may have an opportunity to either enter into that conversation, put items on the agenda, or let us know that you have serious concerns about something and want to have it out as a part of a discussion. We actually reviewed this a little bit at finance when Drew asked a question about our class size targets, which is a rather perfunctory request we make each year. And why did we bring it to finance if it's so perfunctory? And we've tried to establish a three-step process with the board so that there's ample time for board members to give input, ask questions, ample time if there's public interest in the topic to be able to participate in the conversation. So by taking it to finance, which is a recorded meeting, then bringing it to the board for discussion, and then bringing it finally to action gives, you know, really almost a six-week process for every topic that may require an expenditure of district dollars. Sometimes, like tonight, we took the resolution for the appeals both to finance and brought it here because the timeline is so expedited. But typically we're trying to allow for adequate time so that there's proper vetting of a discussion. And I think we've had some concerns that I didn't know I could bring this topic up, or I didn't know that I had other times to discuss something. And so I just thought it would be important for us to talk about this to make sure that we understand that there is a process that flows from finance, and everyone gets the finance agenda to discussion to action. But if there's questions about that process, or if there are questions about, well, I want to talk about something, where do I take it? Mm-hmm. To whom do I take it? what agenda might it go on, and how do we make sure that our ability to communicate with one another does not lead to surprises, does not lead to people not feeling as though they have an ample opportunity to express their opinions about something, because that's how I'm feeling in recent months, is that there may be some occasions when board members don't feel like they've had a chance to voice their viewpoints. And so if our process is not either adequately communicated or we're not utilizing it, what can we do administratively to help the board feel more comfortable in making sure that their viewpoints are heard and have a chance to be vetted by the whole board?
Well, you know, early on, I'm pointing to Dan, who's not here, but I mean, early on in his tenure as a new board member, it was actually at a policy committee meeting where he asked about the process of getting things on the agenda and what the policy would be for that. So we had some conversation around that. And what it made me think about that I did bring to Ann, and I think to Steve too, was, you know, just being reminded of what this meeting is, which is a business meeting. And so there's, you know, as we all know, certain protocol, et cetera. The fact that we get, you know, so Dan understood that, and I think it helped him to do what Ann just said, which is to know where to put things and where to bring things if he had something to speak specifically about. I think sometimes we feel like because there's so much business to get done that some of the business of the board, which might be of a more individual interest, we set aside, or we have a conversation one-to-one, which is legitimate and legal to do that, so that we vet that idea with somebody, which I think can be a good process because it kind of level sets. Am I thinking about this correctly? Did I read this correctly in the Thursday letter, et cetera? And I think that's all valid. The you know, the issue I think that we're talking about most closely is when John brought to the table at the December meeting the discussion about the revenues, which we now have on the agenda, which is exactly the right place for this, so that we can have this conversation. It's a completely appropriate conversation to have. John, at one point in the December meeting, you made the comment that made me feel personally like I wasn't on board with the topic. I'm completely on board with the topic. What I was uncomfortable with, and I was calling in, which made it doubly frustrating, I suppose, because I didn't have any of the nonverbal stuff, was to be voting on something as required by law and be talking about an element of that really needed a longer conversation. So I think it's that kind of thing. If there's something that we have an individual interest on, my sense is we have plenty of time based on when we get the information, how the recommendations are laid out, and those have evolved over the 4 years I've been on the board to be a much stronger recommendation. We have the time. We have to decide what the level of importance is, and we need to get it out there sooner so that the rest of us know what's really important to each other, so we can be good stewards with each other and I think give each other, you know, a good reading, a good hearing.
I think from my perspective, one of the things that I wonder about is our meeting structure. I think when we went to two meetings, we initially said this meeting, first meeting in the month, would be a workshop meeting, which we've tried to keep to some extent that being true. But we even changed our seating so that we sat in a U, and it was really a discussion meeting. It was not a business meeting. It was really about topics like fund balances, and it was topics that, you know, someone might bring to the table without necessarily action following it, but it was something we wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. I think my sense has been just a little bit that we're not, the way we've structured our means, we're not getting enough of that opportunity. And do we need to find a way to get that on the table? Or does the process we have and the structure we have that I mentioned before provide that opportunity?
I think we've lost the workshop dialogue mentality. So, I mean, the concept back then was a workshop, discussion points, and then the next meeting was more of the business meeting.
Right.
I think we've lost the workshop. I mean, I think the finance workshop we had, whenever it was, back in 2010, was a very good dialogue that we all had, and we've got everything out there. And that workshop structure, I think, is good.
That we had a separate meeting, though. That we had a separate special meeting.
That well, one was a special meeting, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, but I think that we could have a, we could still do meetings every 2 weeks and have one of them a workshop and one of them a business meeting, I guess.
I think that's one of the process questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that I think you're right. I mean, even again, just we're back to sitting at the table the way that we have always sat at the table, and I think it just sort of got lost, and no one, I don't want to say we didn't pay attention because we were, but just got lost in the shuffle of getting through the
business.
Things
there's
the
been
business.
A lot of
and I think
too.
that's part of
that ebbs and flows.
The issue at times is that we seem to have a lot of things that we need to get done, and you know, in terms of priorities, there are actions that must be taken, and I don't know if in terms of the workshop format, if we do have action items, maybe it's the reverse. We get through the action items first and then go to the discussion right. So that maybe we have more time to get through a discussion. Just in terms of the workshop model, because we always have consent agenda action
mm-hmm,
items.
Right.
And perhaps, I mean, again, if there are things that are just being voted on as part of the consent agenda or, you know, in discussion, maybe it would be better time spent getting, I don't want to say getting it out of the way, but getting those perfunctory things out of the way first so that we can sit and talk, because I feel like maybe that's where we lose it,
mm-hmm.
is that we don't, because, I mean, even like
yeah.
today, you know, we have something that's very important that we want to talk about, and yet we wanted to ask a lot of questions, which is what we're all, I mean, sorry, Karen, we always ask so many questions, but that's part of our job, is to ask those kinds of questions. Because
which is also an important part of the workshop
of
meeting
the workshop
is being able
meeting.
To learn a little bit more in depth about what's happening.
And that's why I say, so, I mean, now it's, you know, what time,
mm-hmm.
we still have things to get through. If we maybe shift the way we run the agenda, it allows us to continue to freely ask those questions and continue the discussion, you know, that we have. And I think the other thing, you know, I guess maybe being here longer, I forget about putting things on the agenda. I mean, personally, I feel that we've had that discussion. If you want something on the agenda, talk to Steve, talk to Ann, talk to Bob. If it's a finance issue, I mean, if we can't find our voices to say, hey, I want to talk about X,
mm-hmm.
then we have a bigger issue.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, there isn't, I don't know if anything in the last, I mean, even in the last year, last couple of years, that there's really been anything of any of magnitude where we did not have a good 2-3 meetings to be able to have those discussions. And so to suggest that we did not have ample opportunity, you know, about the levy to have these discussions, I mean, I'm just saying, in terms of the way we structure your tiered process, or if it's a finance question or if it's a policy question, whatever the committee type work that's done, that's at committee. There's discussion. We as a board know what's going on. The agenda. I mean, the public knows what's going on in those meetings, and there's no discussion. And then so to get to a vote on whatever that topic may be, and all of a sudden people are coming out of left field. I think as a board member, that's where I struggle to say, wait a minute, we've had these discussions, you've had these opportunities, where were you 6 weeks ago, or where have you been on this topic? We all thought one way, and I think that's, you know, that's a professional thing that we as board members have to take ownership of as well.
Part of it is, you know, the idea of being able to have an open-ended discussion, which, what John was just alluding to, saying he misses that, was that we've lost that, because our discussion has become a precursor to action. And sometimes, and we've used special meetings for the more philosophical conversations, similar to what you know, the December 13th finance meeting, which was a practical conversation, but it was also, you know, trying to get at winnowing away on the master facilities plan. But So most of our discussion time is devoted to something we're going to ask you. It's based in a recommendation. And part of the need of the board is also to have those other conversations. So, you know, when something comes up and it's put on the table, perhaps even in the 11th hour or whenever, but it really is relative to some of our belief systems, how do we get those conversations on the table earlier? And I think, you know, this is not about, you know, I don't see this about any particular incident. I see this more about how does the board have an opportunity to both do its business, mm-hmm. and I think the process that I outlined, I think we've done a good job on. There's ample time to take something from early discussion at finance to discussion to action, but are we missing something mm-hmm. of the other sort, and can we fit that into the current structure that we have by arranging our agenda differently?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the topic. I think there's, you know, when you talk about those open things where it's not, you know, really discussing an administrative recommendation, it's really what should the district be doing? Mm-hmm. We need input from the board. I mean, that's long-range plan. We already set up ways to do that. You know, visioning with our, you know, our teachers, things like mm-hmm. that. Those are very open-ended discussions, so we're not set about needing to vote on an actual recommendation, you know, from the administration. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the issue here we're talking about is really if there are issues with the recommendations, those need to be discussed in a timely manner. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel that, you know, those long-range plan type discussions, we do give those ample time, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's for me, it's just the dialogue between the seven of us on.
And it can't go on forever either. I think that's part of the issue. I mean, we can't restate things. You got to make your point, and if you're not going to sway somebody, you just got to accept the fact that mm-hmm. we're going to take a vote and go on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also. Mm-hmm.
But can we try to go? I mean, maybe the seven of us have to make more of a conscious effort to, you know, do the workshop meeting. Maybe changing the format of that. Like I said, if we have things we got to vote on, let's vote on them first. And
I don't think we need all the staff here.
Right.
It needs to be here to answer questions to get through consent agendas or, you know, things we legally need to do. But really, our philosophy, we don't need mm-hmm. and staff here.
Well, I would agree with that. If we can minimize the need for the staff to hang around listen to this babble, when they, you know.
Well, I know they all download the meetings anyway.
We study. We even listen to it.
Yeah.
I can't even say. Did you say that?
But I guess if I have any level of frustration on not being able to get something out, where I get confused, not frustration, but the confusion for me is, you know, sometimes I'll say something. Like at the Hadley meeting, I said, you know, it'd be nice if we thought about creating a subgroup for, you know, the group that I talk about, which is beyond the, you know, the intervention kids and all that. So I know, you know, I've said that a lot, right? So maybe I should be saying to you, let's, you know, I don't want to get into your business, right? Because we discussed that we wouldn't do that, but, you know, is that something we put on the agenda, or is that something that, you know, I assume when I make a comment like that, maybe it's because I'm used to dealing with boards in the business world more, that, you know, if someone takes a note of that and then some thoughts put behind it, but I never really see kind of a recommendation coming back. So maybe I either need to be stronger to say, hey, I'd like us to discuss that as a board, or you need to maybe ask us, you know, is that something we should discuss or put a recommendation? I don't want to get into the business of, you know, did we fly a portable over or not, and why, you know, I don't want to get into that, right?
I guess my recommendation on that would be that in that case you might ask to have a conversation with me mm-hmm. about what it is we do, to have a better understanding of what exists, and that may happen at a president's meeting, or it might happen in a conversation that you and I have to determine what you know, what you'd like to see happen, what's not happening, and then we can determine from there together whether or not that's an appropriate item to be placed on the agenda. Because sometimes it might be, it's not the appropriate time for us to be able to share with you all the things we are doing. Or you might say, but I want it more formalized. I mean, it may be that you and I need to have a conversation first to kind of flesh that out a little bit before we decide whether it should be asked of the board to make it a formal discussion.
Okay. And I mean, in my tenure on the board, I think we've always gotten to a point, and I miss the dialogue, but I don't see that it's been an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, I understand there's a process and all that, and I'm probably the least to follow a process, so I apologize for that. But in my opinion, there's never a bad time to bring up, you know, an idea. So I think we also have to be cognizant that that can happen, work with each other when that does happen.
I'm guessing from this discussion that a possible next step might be looking at the arrangement of the agenda and arranging it in a almost like most specific to most general order, so that it might be action, discussion, formal discussion that's going to lead to action, and then other discussion topics that would be at the end of the agenda.
Sure.
Staff can choose to stay or not to stay.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll look at rearranging that.
I think your comment, Anne, about issues that we all might have an individual interest around, and being able to again take it to a president meeting, which is a great tool, and I think an underutilized one too, and or to the committee where that lives, whether it's policy or finance right now, but to vet that, because you bring up a really good point. There's so much, and Karen, your presentation tonight, I think, spoke to this, and typically every presentation we have does, whether it's communication or operations or curriculum or whatever. The complexity of how the work gets done, meaning how our children get taught, is beyond us often. It's not our profession, and yet we are bound by our roles to know as much as we can, which is why this information is so critical for us to review and be prepared with. So your point about, you know, coming to you, going to the source, I think is absolutely critical, because that may answer, and for me, in the last 4 years, it has answered sometimes the question, I think, well, why are we doing this? And in fact, there's a good reason why we're not, and or we are, or door number C. So to use that part of the conversation or come to the presence meeting with Steve, I think is important, so that what comes to the agenda has really been vetted. And we can have a really good conversation about it at that point.
Okay. I think also part of the process, because it's the word process here, decision-making process, is the way I assume it is, if we have a position or something we've talked about, we call a president, and we talk to the president. Now, if you have a discussion with the president and not with everybody else, is that okay? And I'm asking that question because...
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as long as the president's informed that you're coming in with something...
Oh, wait a minute.
Well, I mean, a couple hours before the meeting.
I'm sorry.
You call Steve and say, I'm bringing this up tonight at 7:30. I would have a problem with that.
Okay, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, no, I would have a problem with that.
Well, and it's the I guess I'd say from a process standpoint, letting me know allows me to either prepare, because you may have something that we can provide information for, allows the staff to be prepared and help the conversation. If we don't know, then we can't either be prepared to respond, and it just gives the appearance of a little bit of a setup in that case, you know. So if you contact the board president and say, I have an issue with this, I want to bring it up tonight, it helps if you put me in the loop too, because the board president will have to put me in the loop, and so you save a step by putting us both in that loop.
Well, and the other thing, John, I mean, you brought up a good point when at Hadley you asked, can we have that material available to us for the next meeting? You said again tonight, you know, there was some, it must have been in finance, I don't know if there was something that you wanted to be able to have as available to you for that next discussion. And I think we all feel that way. So something comes out of left to what appears to some of us out of left field, despite the fact that somebody may have had a conversation with the board president, we're not prepared to have a meaningful discussion because, we would like a little time to prepare our own thoughts rather than come off, you know, just go off the cuff on a particular topic. I mean, it, again, it, some of it to me is professional courtesy to your peers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Professional courtesy is anyone can call another board member and ask them how they feel about an issue they have concern.
Yeah, I think it's important that we feel like we could contact. For me, it kind of falls into camps, and it's, you know, Bob and Drew are finance, and so when I had a question, I mean, I asked Bob, I emailed him, and he sent me an email back about the conversation that we're going to table to the 18th on fund balance, because I asked him, I said, if you have recommendations, then share them, because then I can wrap my arms around that. But to have a conversation that starts here without, you know, background is more difficult. I mean, we all prepare differently, we all, you know, take in information differently, and so it's just being, I think, also aware of how each of us operates, and that certainly takes time to figure out. I think we're at a good point with that now, because we're all 2 and 4 years and more with you guys, you know, on the board. I mean, but the other thing, and I think this is a protocol issue too, and I remember this from board orientation, was that if we had a question of the board president, that it would be always to copy Ann on that, so that our superintendent, you know, has a sense of what's going on and could then give information, provide a chart, you know, whatever that might be. So I would, and that came up when I talked with Dan about agenda items, that that's just a matter of course that you should always copy, you know, those folks on it. So, so I think we should feel free to go to each other as partners to vet information, and that's legal. That's not outside of the Open Meetings Act, and I think it helps us to, you know if we're understanding what we're reading or a comment somebody made or whatever it might be. I think that's completely important. I think it's important.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So, again, we're going to have our acceptable uses of accumulated fund balances discussion in another meeting, and we'll get some background information ahead of time, I guess, on that to help facilitate discussion. Okay. All right, next up are action items. So we have the consent agenda. Are there any items board members would like removed from the consent agenda to be considered separately?
Okay. Oh, the case, remove the case.
No, we'll just, okay. We'll correct that.
Okay.
Why would we make
the motion? The case minutes referenced me making a motion at a case meeting that I was not in attendance at.
Okay.
It's a typo. And I wasn't remote either. I literally wasn't there.
All right. Hearing none, may I have a motion to approve the consent agenda as presented, which includes the Human Resources Personnel Report with Employment Recommendations, the Finance, Facilities, and Operations Treasurer's Report, Investment Schedule, Monthly Revenue Expenditure Summary Report, Summary of Bills and Payroll, the School District Payment Order, the Vandalism Damage Report, the Disposal of Surplus Property, and the 2010-2011 FOIA Report, and also the December 6th, 2010 Board Meeting Minutes from the Public Hearing, Regular Meeting, and Closed Session Minutes, and also the Case Board Meeting Action Items.
Motion.
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Mr. Sola?
Yes.
Mr. Evans? Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mrs. Howard?
Yes.
Mr. Bonnier?
Yes. Okay, our next meetings will be January 18th, 2011 at Churchill School. Is that Tuesday or Monday?
It's a Tuesday.
Because it's a holiday on the Monday. Okay. And then February 7th, 2011, back here at Central Services. So, are there any other matters to be considered by the board?
All right, so you're going to laugh. I'm going to go right out of protocol here. We just said it, but I was wondering about the board desk. Are you still looking into the board desk?
We haven't. We could bring them here for a decision. We should probably put that on as something for discussion.
Okay.
That's a good
board. What?
Board docs.
It's electronic.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's called board docs,
board
but it's.
Board
I'm sorry.
Book.
There's two
board
competing.
Book. Board book.
Software.
Yeah. But we saw it by conference.
That's on a future agenda.
It's not on the iPad, man. It's not cool.
Does it keep pinging Kenwood till he actually reads it?
It's web-based. It's web-based, John, so.
Oh, it's not an app.
But thank you, Jerry.
Use it on Linux box if you want. But okay.
Accelerometer.
Yeah. All right. No other items to be considered. At this time, we have, again, public participation. Are there any members of the board who wish to address the board? Okay, seeing none. The board has determined the need to adjourn to closed session to discuss the employment, compensation, discipline, performance, or dismissal of specific employees of the district or legal counsel for the district, including hearing testimony on a complaint lodged against an employee or against legal counsel for the district to determine its validity. May I have a motion to adjourn to closed session?
Motion.
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Mr. Howard?
Yes.
Mr. Kenworth?
Yes.
Mr. Nelson?
Yes.
Yes, and we will not be taking any action when we return to open session.